Welcome to the Whiskey Rebellion. This is David Silkenet in Edinburgh. I'm joined as always by Frank Cogliano. How you doing, Frank?
I'm doing great, David. I'm doing great. Marking dissertations like you, so I'm a happy guy.
If any of our dissertation students are listening, we are enjoying marking your dissertations.
We love you all.
And to our colleagues out there who are also marking dissertations.
God bless you.
All right. So over the weekend, Americans commemorate the life of Barbara Bush, who passed away last week. She, of course, was the wife of George H.W. Bush and the mother of George W. Bush. And so we thought we would take this episode to talk a little bit about first ladies.
Right. Actually, listeners, sorry, you have to hear what goes on in the background of this program. I suggested first ladies as a topic. And David came back and said, first ladies are boring, and had to be persuaded to do this. David, would you like to defend yourself on the air, please?
All right. So,
explain your why do you hate first ladies, David?
Why
do
I hate
why do you hate America, David?
That's a longer answer than you want, Frank. So my concern with... I think the ways in which Americans relate to first ladies, speaks to a kind of celebrity culture that I find distasteful. I think that kind of obsession with sort of the biographies of first ladies and what it means to be a first lady in a democratic society, it seems like there's some tension there that I don't think... really sort of fits in with the American discourse. And sort of the example 1A for this is at the Smithsonian Institute, where since 1914, one of their permanent exhibits has to do with the first ladies of the United States.
And so you say that with slight contempt, though.
But you go into the Smithsonian, which is the Museum of American History, this one supposed to tell you the story of the country and what the country means, and they devote a permanent part of the exhibit, a very limited space they have to share the American story, to have dresses of the first lady, and the first to be sure, some of these women are important historical figures who influenced politics in various ways, but if you want to counterbalance everything else in American history, versus the amount of attention given to what, Lady Bird Johnson wore at her inauguration, that strikes me as there's something in slightly almost monarchical about first ladies, even about sort of the title and the ways in which it's, a position that doesn't have a constitutional role. It's a position that, in some ways, the United States elevates the role of the first lady, above the way other kinds of democracies around the world elevate the spouses of their elected leaders.
Well, in part, so there's a lot going on there, which is why I thought we should actually start with this. And I'm in broad sympathy with you, as you know. But I want to push back on a little bit of that. In part, I guess, in other countries, the executive is not necessarily the head of state, such as the country we're sitting in
Yes.
right now, where the prime minister is not the head of state. The queen is, who celebrated a birthday over the weekend herself. And in France, the roles of the prime minister and the president...
One of her two birthdays.
Yes. Don't get me started on monarchy. And in France, the president and the prime minister are not the same.
Sure.
And so these roles are separated in many other democracies in ways that might be helpful. They're not separated in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And so given that the president is both the kind of, obviously, the chief executive within the government, but also the head of state, the president's spouse... actually serves a quite important role. So there's a state dinner this week for the French Prime Minister
sure.
Macron, and President Trump and Melania Trump will play a quite significant role in hosting that dinner, or Melania Trump in particular, because the First Lady, you're right, the role is extra-constitutional. But as Catherine Al Gore has shown on a historian in my period on down, the First Ladies have played a significant role in the politics of the country, despite having this extra-constitutional role. And I mean, your critique is a valid one, but you might as well, and this is a valid critique to make, I'd be interested to hear your response to it, say, well, we just give too much attention to high politics as a culture.
Well, I think we do that too.
Right, okay.
But I mean, I think the difference is when we pay attention to high politics, I think high politics has consequences that filter down to the lives of everyday Americans. The choices that the president makes about foreign policy, about domestic policy, about taxes, about all kinds of things matter to people on the ground. You know, whereas, you know, you can find exceptional first ladies where they do have an influence on politics, but usually it's a second order effect. But the amount of attention that we give to first ladies often vastly, you know, it speaks to kind of a celebrity culture rather than a, you know, something worthy of historical analysis and insight. I mean, probably the example, there's a number of examples you could sort of point to, but if you look at like Jackie Kennedy, who has had more biographies written about her than, you know, the vast number of civil rights activists or labor activists or other important people that Americans should know something about, as far as I can tell, she had almost no influence on the politics of the early 1960s. She redecorated the White House and did a nice TV special about it, and she, you know, was very fashionable. But I don't think she was massively influential otherwise beyond that.
Well, except, I mean, I, again, I'm broadly sympathetic with what you're saying, but I want to push back a little bit. That's how this program works. Her role, particularly that TV special, particularly her sense of style, and I'm not one to talk about style and fashion.
We are both very stylish podcasters.
Yes.
You have no idea, guys. We're both dressed out to the nines right now.
Yes. We only wear tuxedos when we broadcast. Her style and that TV special, and of course, being the martyred widow, beautiful young widow with young children, kind of fixed her position in American life. However, during his JFK's presidency, to some extent, the whole Camelot myth was built on their relationship, and she was key to that. So I think she's a significant figure. You're right; she's not interested. She was not interested in policy; didn't seem to influence policy in any way. But part of the legacy of JFK, she played a huge role in the construction of the Camelot myth and consequently in kind of safeguarding and promoting the legacy of JFK. So she's an important historic figure. You're right. Is she as important as major civil rights leaders who were contemporaries of hers? No, of course not. I wouldn't suggest that. But even somebody like Jackie Kennedy has a historic significance that we need to appreciate. You're right. I mean, I don't think it matters what Lady Bird Johnson wore at an inauguration, but I think certain first ladies, like certain presidents, have had an outside influence on American life. It's very hard to tell the story, at least the story of American political history, for the past 30 years. Without Hillary Clinton. Now, Hillary Clinton's achievements are not simply confined to being First Lady, but that was a big part of her achievement.
Well, and she's in some ways an outlier, right? I mean, right. If we look at the history of people who have been First Lady, and we should point out that not everyone who is taking that sort of ceremonial role is necessarily the president's wife. There's sometimes, like with your man Thomas Jefferson,
where it's
a daughter. There's one case where it's a sister, or it's a, you know, there's usually a woman who has that sort of ceremonial.
Yeah, I think gender's an important dimension
to it. You know,
it's normally a wife.
It's normal, but normally, so, but you know, not universally. You know, there are a handful of them where I think we can sort of point to actually people who had meaningful political impact into their experience actually is, you know, worthy of real serious historical analysis beyond their choice of what they wore on Inauguration Day. Who do you think would be on sort of the top 10 list or the top 5 list of first ladies that really, you know, made a difference or mattered politically?
I think Martha Washington. You know, I think the Washingtons, you know, as always, figure prominently for setting precedents. To some extent, the first lady, and particularly the royal aspects of it, which you've noted, go right back to Washington's presidency and the sort of levies that the Washingtons used to hold, that Jefferson disdain for being monarchical. So I think Martha Washington is probably on that list. I think, and I'd be interested to hear your views about Mary Todd Lincoln, but Mary Todd Lincoln is certainly a very significant figure. Not necessarily a positive figure, but a significant figure, and I'll give you a chance to respond to that. Edith Wilson, Woodrow Wilson's second wife, who after his stroke in 1919 appears to have been acting as president of the United States. Hugely significant. Eleanor Roosevelt, of course.
She's number one.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going chronologically, but I think she's the number one most influential. No doubt about that. I think I've said what I need to say about Jackie Kennedy. I don't think she was a significant political figure. I think she was a significant cultural figure whose influence was political, either intended or unintended. I think Nancy Reagan was a really important figure politically, and a bit of a lightning rod, but also was important in an important influence on her husband and his presidency. I think Hillary Clinton. I think Hillary Clinton. I think Barbara Bush is interesting because she's a bit like Abigail Adams. She's noted for being both the first lady and the mother of a president. There are only two women who've ever had that both those roles, Abigail Adams and Barbara Bush. I think Barbara Bush is interesting for her role. She seems to have been not just the wife of George Bush and the mother of George W. Bush, but also she's very much the kind of matriarch of a very large political dynasty. So she's significant in that way, but I don't think she's first tier. But I think the three most influential first ladies in order of importance would probably be Eleanor Roosevelt, Hillary Clinton, and Edith Wilson.
I think I'll agree with all of those. And the only one you didn't name that I would probably throw on the list might be Dolly Madison.
Yes. Yeah.
Because in some ways, Dolly Madison sort of builds on the precedent set by Martha Washington, Abigail Adams, to sort of solidify what this position is in terms of it's a ceremonial position, it's a supporting position, but it is, you know, there's legitimacy attached to it as a confidant and aide of the president, somebody who informs his political views. And that, I think, is largely the role that first ladies have throughout the 19th century. Mary Todd Lincoln's an interesting case because she was not a very... she was a controversial first lady in a couple of important respects. One is that she had several half-brothers and I think one full brother who fought for the Confederacy. She was from a Southern...
Awkward!
She was from a Southern slaveholding family. And so, you know, there's that belief that she was not fully sort of loyal to the Union or had some Confederate sympathies. That was a strike against her. The other strike against her is that she redecorated the White House. The previous occupant of the White House, notably James Buchanan, was actually the one person who didn't have a first lady. He was unmarried. I think for a while his niece sort of played that ceremonial role. But Mary Todd Lincoln came into the White House and thought that the place was a wreck and decided to spend a lot of money redecorating it. And Congress didn't think it was a great idea to spend a lot of money making the White House look nice in the same time in which young men are being sent off to die. So she was not necessarily politically popular. So she was controversial, in that respect. And obviously later in her life, she had all kinds of sort of emotional issues, as one would have after losing a couple of children and her husband under fairly tragic circumstances. But I think the person who really takes this role and transforms it and makes it into something different is Eleanor Roosevelt. Because she was somebody who was, in some ways, they're kind of like the Clintons, in as much as both Franklin Roosevelt and Eleanor Roosevelt were politically active in different ways before, you know, he becomes president. You know, her political thoughts actively informed him and pushed him in various ways. She was, I think, for the most part, far more liberal and progressive than he was. And so the extent to which
we... Certainly on questions like civil rights.
To be sure, right? You know, she was... you know, and so I think we can attribute her bringing a number of political actors into the sort of presidential orbit that would influence the New Deal and had really significant effects, thinking about the effects that these has sort of filtering down. And she was also visible in a way that previous first ladies weren't. She had a monthly newspaper column. She appeared on the radio. She had lots of press conferences. So she was a politically active and in some ways slightly independent voice from her husband. I mean, she would say things that were not necessarily fully part of the, you know, Roosevelt party line when she gave news conferences and she said, well, my husband thinks this. I'm not quite sure about that. And I think that sort of spoke to a kind of unique political activism that she had. And obviously after her husband's death, her political activism continues afterwards. She's the first U.S. Delegate to the United Nations after the United Nations was formed in 1945.
Right, and she serves in that role quite prominently for a good few years. I mean, so she has a significant... I don't know whether we've done an episode on the post-presidency. If we haven't, we will.
Yeah, no, we have. Yeah.
Right. You know, but she has a post-presidential life that's quite awkward, not just curating her husband's memory. In fact, it's not related to that at all in many cases. And she becomes a kind of important senior figure within the Democratic Party after her husband's death. Would this be different? I mean, I think, David, our sympathies, and I want to talk about some of the more contemporary ones, but I realize that our top three, you know, if we're talking about Eleanor Roosevelt and Hillary Clinton, and even Edith Wilson, Edith Wilson's a problematic figure in some ways.
Because Edith Wilson, for those people who don't know the story, when Wilson had his stroke in, I guess, 1919,
after he got back from Versailles,
he was basically bedridden, unable to really perform the functions of the presidency, and exactly how mentally capable he was during that time, I'm not sure we really know. But the supposition is that she made a lot of the executive decisions in his place. Now, she's doing this when nobody knows this is going on. This is in a media world in which Wilson's illness was hidden from the public. And so everyone assumed that these were decisions that were coming from the president, not the president's wife. So that, you know, in terms of actually changing the role of the first lady, she's, you know, in some ways doing that very much behind the scenes.
Right, and I think you've made a really good distinction between the public role of the first lady and the influence of one's spouse on one's career anyway. And I think you're right that the kind of modern public role for the first lady does start with Eleanor Roosevelt. The question I wanted to ask was, would this be different? I think for anyone who's listened to our podcast for a while, we'll probably know where our political sympathies lie. And I note that we picked, as at least our top two, Eleanor Roosevelt and Hillary Clinton as most influential. Perhaps if we were of a different political persuasion, would we have picked, say, Nancy Reagan, Barbara Bush maybe, or Laura Bush, or so? I mean, are we being unfair?
Well, okay, so when we think about these other modern first ladies, you know, I think there's a step back after Eleanor Roosevelt where there's a position that's established for first lady where the first lady is very interested in... they usually sort of adopt a particular social cause. You know, for various... So for Nancy Reagan, it was just say no to drugs. For Laura Bush, it was...
Wasn't it literacy?
It was literacy, you know. And so they often have... for Lady Bird Johnson, it was the environment, right? And so
Melania Trump is against online bullying.
Yeah, I've heard that's a problem where people go on Twitter and say bad things about other people. She should talk to some anyway. But in some ways, one of the
Michelle Obama was healthy.
Yeah, in some ways, I think those are actually harking back to a very traditional role for the First Lady. One of the thinking about sort of the ideas about Republican motherhood from the Revolutionary era, one of the virtues that women are supposed to have is they're supposed to have a greater sort of moral sense than men are, and are supposed to provide moral guidance to both their husbands and their sons. Thinking about Abigail Adams and Barbara Bush, and especially in those respects. And so the kind of positions that, you know, causes that, that First Ladies take up, I think, fit into that sort of niche where they are taking on particular moral issues that face the country, whether it's drug abuse or illiteracy or, you know, destruction of the environment, and take that on as a personal cause. You know, Eleanor Roosevelt, I think, was an exception in as much as she's stepping outside of that particular role. You know, likewise, when we think about you know, Hillary Clinton, one of the things that happened when they were the Clintons were running together, one of the things that happened when the Clintons were running together was is that they actually sort of positioned themselves as a buy one get one free kind of presidency, where you know, not only are you going to get Bill's expertise and experience, but you're also going to get Hillary's. And you know, when in the his first year in office, he tasks her, or she takes on the role of overseeing healthcare reform, and goes before Congress and tries to, you know, testify to a way in which healthcare can be reformed. Many Americans saw that as the First Lady stepping outside of the sort of prescribed bounds of what the First Lady is supposed to do. First Lady is supposed to give platitudes about just say no to drugs, not actually implement or be involved in actual policy-making processes. Hillary Clinton got a lot of backlash from that. And if you saw what happened then after that first year, she stepped back a bit from that more hands-on active policy role that she had in her first year.
That's right. I mean, she started with more of an Eleanor Roosevelt kind of role. In fact, arguably went beyond that. Mm. And you're right. It was buy one, get two. And this was seen as an asset. And they totally misread the mood of the country, clearly, on that. Mm. And she did become a more traditional First Lady, although clearly she had a very significant, like Eleanor Roosevelt, a political career after her husband's presidency, which was very interesting.
One thing that struck me about Michelle Obama's tenure as First Lady is in some ways she actually also is fitting into a very traditional model of what a First Lady does, even if she was, you know, an extraordinarily accomplished professional before, you know, her husband became president. You know, the things she did as First Lady were about her sort of signature cause was childhood obesity and having a garden in the White House and all these kinds of things, is not that dissimilar from what Nancy Reagan or Barbara Bush or
Laura Bush, right? Yeah. But I guess one of the things First Ladies try to do is rise above politics in most cases. Except for the two we've highlighted, Eleanor Roosevelt and Hillary Clinton are exceptions to this. And you pick causes like eating vegetables or literacy that everybody, at least in theory, very hard. It's hard to be against reading or vegetables. Although it's easier to be against vegetables than reading, in my mind. but you know what I mean. So they choose a cause that should bind people together. And first ladies are often seen as above whatever the political controversy of the day is. And given the amount of abuse they sometimes suffer, and I think this was particularly true in the case of Michelle Obama, I think I think they have to try to rise above politics. And Hillary Clinton was an exception to that rule, and she has the scars to prove it, really. And I think Eleanor Roosevelt was also attacked by the opposition press, and so it's a trickier role than it seems. It's not just hosting parties, although hosting parties is a big part of it.
No, I mean, if you look at the office of the First Lady, they have a whole staff, and one of whom is the official White House florist, is you know, reports to the First Lady.
I mean, one of the First Ladies we haven't talked about, of course, is Abigail Bartlett from the West Wing, who's one of the few First Ladies who actually continued in her career whilst being First Lady. And, of course, she is fictional.
Yes.
So we don't have First Ladies who continue in whatever their career is, if they had a career.
Well, we have a second lady, though, who did, in Jill Biden.
Yes.
Who was still taught, I believe she taught at community college in Delaware.
Right.
While her husband was vice president. So that's...
Although that role is a little bit different.
That's a slightly, yes, to be sure. Now, one thing that could have happened a year and a half ago and didn't happen a year and a half ago, but hopefully will happen at some point in the future, or will happen in the future, how much in the future is up for debate, is that the First Lady role will be held by somebody who is not, at least the way these things are usually conscribed, a lady.
Yes, I mean, at her famous commencement address at Wellesley College, which is a women's college, of course, in I think 1990 or 91, Barbara Bush, and when Barbara Bush was nominated to give the commencement address and given an honorary degree, there was some pushback at Wellesley about this because she was a Republican and so on. It was politically motivated pushback. But in her commencement address, Barbara Bush said words to the effect of, there is likely somebody in the audience who will be the spouse to a president of the United States, and I hope he will do a very good job. So she, this story has been told a number of times in the weeks since Barbara Bush died. And I think, so you agree with her on that at least, David. And you're right, it will be interesting. I mean, there was a lot of speculation in the run-up to the 2016 election, especially when people were assuming that Hillary Clinton would win, as to what the role of the so-called first gentleman would be.
Yes.
Particularly given that the first gentleman in that case would have been a former president of the United States, which is particularly difficult. I mean, when that happens, and it's when, not if, of course.
Oh, too sure.
It'll be very interesting because we'll be in terra incognita in social terms. It'll be very interesting to see how that particular individual handles the role, and very important because he will be, or they together, will be setting a new precedent for the future. And maybe it'll change some of the things that you're unhappy about the First Lady's role.
Maybe. I mean, it still strikes me as somewhat anti-democratic to have this sort of person who has power and authority based on who they're married to.
I agree, but there are all kinds of monarchical
vestiges
around the presidency.
To be sure.
And whether those are because of the British roots of the Constitution of the United States or,
patriarchy from the 18th century generally. Yeah,
or something innate in human beings and, countries with heads of state, take on these roles even if they're democracies or even undemocratic countries that are not monarchies. So it's interesting. So we're in kind of, we might be in new territory. In terms of Barbara Bush, did you see the photo that was widely circulated yesterday?
I did see that, yes.
So it was, let me make sure I get this right, it was the Clintons, the Obamas, George and Laura Bush with George H.W. Bush sitting in his wheelchair in the foreground, and Melania Trump.
Yes.
That was everyone. And it's quite a nice photo, actually. Mm. And Maggie Haberman of the New York Times, among others, retweeted it. And many people drew a contrast between the sort of spirit of comedy in that in that picture and the kind of current moment in Washington. Mm. I have two responses to that. One is, I actually think Donald Trump did the right thing in not attending the funeral.
I think that's...
Because there's a lot of antipathy between the Bush family and Trump. And I actually think he did the right thing in not attending the funeral and not drawing attention to himself, even though he's been criticized and people have drawn a contrast between the way the right wing media in particular criticized Barack Obama for not attending Nancy Reagan's funeral and the pass they gave to Donald Trump. But I actually think Trump shouldn't be criticized for his non attendance. I actually think that was the right thing to do, and quite sensitive. I don't know who was responsible for that decision, but it was the right decision. The second thing I would say is much was made of, these are all the living presidents are represented here. No, they're not.
Mm.
Jimmy and Rosalind Carter are still alive.
Yes.
Now, I think that they're both Well, they're both very elderly and not in good health, so I don't think there was any antipathy. I don't think there was any statement there. Mm. But these were not representatives of all the living presidents. So those are my two responses. What did you think of the photo?
I thought it was interesting the ways in which some of the people were positioned in that photo. Bill very much is in the background, and Hillary is very much in the foreground. I thought
Hillary's really short.
Yes.
Yeah. No,
I think she was wearing flats for
once. Right, okay. But I mean, that was striking.
Yes. Well, I think that also the Michelle Obama's height, I think, you know,
was ridiculous. Michelle Obama is tall. Barbara Bush was taller than Hillary Clinton.
Yes.
I offer that simply as an observation because I see them all together. I'm not making any... I'm short. We talked about this last week.
Yes. you know, the interesting thing about, you know, thinking about the First Lady and what it means today is that, you know, in some ways... Donald Trump is actually using two different people as first ladies. He's using his wife,
yes.
And he's using his daughter. And part of that, I think, is that his wife doesn't particularly want to inhabit many of the roles that the first lady traditionally does. She doesn't. The first lady's become a more visible political figure over time. Like, the first lady often gives a speech at the presidential convention, and Melania didn't seem like she wanted to do that. And partially because she plagiarized part of her speech. But, you know, her command of English isn't wonderful. I think she doesn't really like that visible speaking mouthpiece.
In fairness to her, she didn't choose the role.
To be sure. She chose to marry. Anyway, that's a different different debate. Whereas, you know, I think she, you know, Ivanka Trump is much more comfortable in public and wants to have that kind of position.
Yes, what's very interesting is Donald Trump has elevated Ivanka to the kind of unappointed yet politically significant role that Hillary Clinton fulfilled in the Clinton presidency. So she's out there in political terms in a way that's...
And speaking for the president.
Right. On policy.
Obviously, yes, yeah. So I thought that was a very interesting, you know, the juxtaposition of Melania Trump with the other people in that photo was quite striking because she didn't look very comfortable being there for, I think, fairly obvious reasons.
Although there was another nice photo that went around over the weekend
of
she and Barack Obama having a laugh. I don't know the particular context. It's quite a sweet photo, actually, because it's the first time we seem to have seen her smile.
Yes.
Sincerely in a long time.
Right
now.
Or, yes.
It was a very nice photo, actually. Anything to add on First Ladies?
I think I've exhausted my appetite for discussing this particular position.
Well, I thank you for your indulgence,
David, okay.
Because I won't say he did so under duress, but you were less enthusiastic about this as a topic.
Okay.
One of the things that happened, and this happens periodically, thanks to the world of social media, is in the aftermath of Barbara Bush's death, a English professor at Fresno State University in California named Randa Jarrar went on a bit of a tweet storm. It began with a tweet in which she more or less said, "I'm glad Barbara Bush is dead." The key phrases in her tweet were that Barbara Bush was, quote, "an amazing racist," which is a very interesting use of language. Mm. And that she and her husband raised a war criminal for a son, that is George W. Bush. And this led to a prolonged, now deleted, series of exchanges on Twitter between Professor Jarrar and several people who took offense at her comments, in one of which she invoked her tenured status as a full-time member of staff with tenure at Fresno State, and said, "I can say what I want. I can't be fired." Mm. She also invoked her salary, which probably was a little bit ill-judged, in my view. And this thing has blown up. She's now deleted her account, and she—I won't say she's in hiding, but she's not on campus anymore for the time being.
I believe there were death threats against her.
Yes,
so I think it seems
yes.
Like
so,
it's
so
well advised.
There's a kind of ritual to all of this when people go too far on Twitter, particularly when people on the left go too far in criticizing President Trump. But there was a very intense backlash She was particularly provocative, not just in these comments, but she invited people. She copied in the Twitter account of the president of the university, which I'm sure he welcomed. Mm. And so the president of the university's been dragged into this. The university's been placed under a lot of pressure to discipline her in some ways. I raise this in part because this periodically happens in the current political moment, but also it's raised some issues about the limits of free speech on social media, the difference between what one says as a private individual and a public figure, and the question of tenure, because people have been saying she could be disciplined or should be disciplined for these comments despite her tenured status. So I wonder if you have any response to this.
Well, I mean, I think this is part of an ongoing debate about campuses as venues for free speech, and I think there are claims on both sides that people are being silenced on campus. Milo Yiannopoulos, the sort of right-wing provocateur, has been going on campus tours, giving fairly incendiary speeches for several years, and various campuses have disinvited him, and right-wing commentators are saying, look, here, you're silencing right-wing voices on campus. Here we've got a case of, presumably a left-wing voice, and people want to silence her on campus.
Well, her voice wasn't on campus, though. I mean, Yiannopoulos is interesting because it seems to me he deliberately wants to be banned because
that's his brand.
So to some extent, that's performance art, if you will, if that's the right way, or theater. It's political theater rather than performance art. Whereas Professor Girard, it seems to me, made these comments on social media, which of course is, Twitter is not a private.
Twitter is hyper public.
It's the public square. There's no doubt about that. But she made a statement in public. It's not the same as she wasn't invited to campus,
to be sure.
Right. Didn't say these in the context. She didn't say it in a lecture.
To be sure.
I mean, I don't think you or I would get up in a lecture and say Barbara Bush was an amazing racist who raised a war criminal son and I'm glad she's dead.
Well, one of the problems with Twitter generally is that complex ideas don't translate in the limited number of characters Twitter gives you.
Sure.
If you were to give a lecture that says maybe we should complicate Barbara Bush's legacy in part because she made various comments over her long life that hint at certain kinds of racial prejudices that she made after Hurricane Katrina, or at various points when she was first lady or when she was second lady that were questionable based on the racial politics of them, and the various ways in which you can be critical of George W. Bush's policies in Iraq and other places. There's a way in which in 10,000 words you can say we should be more nuanced in our understanding of Barbara Bush's legacy than the kind of platitudes
that 280 characters allows.
To be sure. Twitter tends to sort of distill things to their worst possible form. Or occasionally its best possible form, but that's far rarer. And so I think if she had given a think piece about how we should consider Barbara Bush's legacy, that would have been fine. Or at least would not have aroused the same kind of anger that...
So she'd written an op-ed piece for the Fresno Bee.
Yes.
That was critical of Barbara Bush.
But in a sort of nuanced, balanced, semi-balanced way, saying we should remember her for her service as, a support person for her husband and her role as a matriarch of the family, whatever it is you want to say that's nice about her. One of the things that happens is that any time any political leaders in the United States die, people tend to, make these very sort of rose-tinted obituaries. I mean, I remember when Nixon died, people tended to say, oh, he was a great statesman, and, also the kinds of nonsense overlooking the various crimes he committed as president of the United States against the very integrity of the democracy. Barbara Bush is like that, but times, two, where people were amazingly laudatory last week. I don't know whether those justify. I haven't studied her in detail enough to know the extent to which she was a really good person or not.
Well, we're also back to the fact that the First Lady's role is different from the President's role as well. So maybe they should be judged by a different standard, or the First Spouse.
I mean, I'm not sure you should judge anybody based on the actions of their children necessarily. Anyway.
Well, yes, as parents ourselves, I think accusing her. I think George W. Bush has a lot to answer for, but I'm not sure Barbara Bush is responsible for his actions as president of the United States.
I mean, I think maybe
he's a fully formed adult then.
Yeah, I mean, I think some of her statements about poor people of color, at various points in time over her life, are probably ill-considered. They're probably a product of the fact that she was 90 years old, and grew up in a particular social context. Not to excuse them, but to contextualize them.
What do you think of the... I'm interested in the tenure issue, though. Oh. So Professor Girard was speaking in social media. I think her comments were probably ill-judged. I think basically when somebody dies, if you can't say something nice, don't say anything at all in the immediate aftermath of their death.
Yeah. I mean,
in most cases.
I would generally agree with that, I guess.
That's my personal view. But what she said was offensive to many people. Mm. I don't think it was the worst thing anybody's ever said on Twitter.
No.
I think Donald Trump has said worse things in the past 72 hours. But it was what she said, her initial tweets and her responses to those tweets when criticized, were pretty outspoken. And but she did so as a tenured professor.
Yeah. So tenure as a phenomenon, I think, is, at least in this particular political moment, far more hollow than it ever has been. Tenure in theory back in the day gave you sort of intellectual freedom to pursue things that were not popular and vocalize opinions that were not in the mainstream. I'm not sure that was ever really the case. The extent to which tenured people actually used that supposed power, we can think of a very limited number of handful of cases in which that happened. But I think in this particular political climate, especially in public universities, or even in private universities, I think the degree of protection that tenure offers is relatively limited. I didn't see her comments as being outside the bounds of relevant political commentary. I would see things that would be sort of tenure violations as things that are really morally reprehensible, actions that brought harm to people. An ill-considered tweet, doesn't necessarily sort of extend to that.
I agree with you. And I think a key distinction is it wasn't as though... Now, I think tenure should allow us, or allow our American colleagues, because tenure was abolished in this country a generation ago, pretty wide latitude to say what they will in the classroom. But she didn't say this in the classroom.
Right.
She said it in a much broader forum, of course, but she wasn't necessarily saying in her capacity as a professor at Fresno State, although she's the one who invoked her employment status as a defense, in part because she was criticized. Because she was criticized, not in part. But I think the tenure issue, and you're right, tenure seems to be under threat, particularly for political reasons in the United States, and that's a worry, or should be a worry for people across the political spectrum. Anyway, I think it's an interesting case. Alas, these things happen periodically, and there'll be other examples, I'm sure.
All right, I think it's time for last drops. Frank, yes. What do you got?
I have a TV program to recommend to people.
All right.
If you're grading dissertations and need a distraction, or exams at this time of year, it's called Mindhunter, which is on Netflix. It's a Netflix production. Many of our listeners have probably seen it. I really like it. It's about the early efforts of the FBI to set up a kind of behavioral unit to hunt serial killers. They don't even use the phrase serial killers yet. They talk about sequence killers. and it's kind of set in the mid to late 1970s. It's a really well done program. And one reason I like it is it really captures the zeitgeist of the 70s, the cars they're driving, the way they dress. How difficult it is to communicate with people because you have to use phones and so on, and it's and flying. They also smoke and drink a lot.
It's like Mad Men,
in that regard. But it's a very, very good program.
Well, in an earlier episode, you recommended The Americans, which strikes me as a very similar kind of thing. And I've actually just started, my wife and I have just started watching The Americans over the weekend. And we're, I think, struck by the similar kinds of ways in which they're evoking, you know, a particular moment in time, you know, in that case, the early 1980s.
Yeah, The Americans is great. That's great. Yeah. History can be fun, boys and girls. What's your last drop, David?
So I just wanted, there's been a news story this weekend, I think it is interesting thinking about the removal of monuments that we've been talking about on and off from the show for really its whole history, and that is the removal of a statue in New York City, actually not far from where I used to live, a statue to J. Marion Sims, who is considered to be the father of gynecology, or one of the fathers of gynecology, if you will. And he's an extraordinarily controversial figure. He was from South Carolina, and he was a slaveholder in South Carolina and Alabama, who is most famous for developing a number of gynecological techniques and procedures and surgeries and things. But he honed his technique largely on experimenting on enslaved women. And so the statue was put up in the 1930s, I believe, and has recently been removed by the city of New York because it was such a, you know, it was difficult to sort of celebrate his achievements in gynecology without recognizing the horrors of the kinds of procedures that he was conducting on enslaved women without their consent, without the use of anesthesia. So I think they've removed the statue from 105th Street, where it was on 5th Avenue, to a graveyard in one of the outer boroughs where he's buried. But I think it sort of speaks to this, you know, extent to which a lot of modern medical science is built upon the, you know, exploitation of the bodies of the poor and the bodies of minorities, thinking about, you know, putting this in the context with the HeLa cells, the Henrietta Lacks story, put in the context of the sort of Tuskegee experiment, the ways in which, you know, black bodies were seen as being venues for science to make advances without respect to the, you know, welfare of the patient. So I'm very glad the statue's gone. It's probably taken too long for it to be taken down.
Right. Okay.
on that depressing note.
Yeah, exactly.
Cheers.
Cheers.
The Whiskey Rebellion is hosted by David Silkenet and Frank Cogliano. David is a senior lecturer in American history at the University of Edinburgh, and Frank is professor of American history and Dean International for North America at the University of Edinburgh. The Whiskey Rebellion is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Podbean. You can follow the show on Twitter at Whiskey Rebel Pod, and like the show on Facebook for updates about current and future episodes.